p.m. Tuesday through Friday, and catering. Bavir Cafe is student-operated and newly remodeled on the second floor of Bavir Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Johann Reinhardt. He is an archaeologist, and he is a specialist in a field of archaeology that doesn't really have all that many members. He is a high-altitude archaeologist. He does his work on the tops of mountains. He is explorer-in-residence at the National Geographic Society, and we'll be talking this morning about some of the work that he's done in Peru. Back in 1995, he made a remarkable discovery in Peru. He found one of the world's most perfectly frozen mummies, an Inca girl who came to be called the Ice Maiden. Today, the Ice Maiden, along with some other discoveries that he and others made, remain some of the best preserved mummies ever found. He has written about his experiences in a recently published book that's titled The Ice Maiden, Inca Mummies, Mountain Gods, and Sacred Sites in the Andes. It's published by National Geographic Books. It came out a little bit earlier this summer. And if you're interested, you can seek it out in the bookstore. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, Johann Reinhardt. He is, in addition to being the explorer-in-residence at the National Geographic Society, he is a senior research fellow at the Mountain Institute in Washington, D.C. He's a visiting professor at Catholic University in Salta, Argentina, and also an honorary professor at Catholic University in Arequipa in Peru. Since 1980, he's conducted anthropological field research in Peru, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, and Ecuador. He also lived more than 10 years in the Himalaya and did anthropological research in Nepal, in Tibet, in Bhutan, and India. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Dr. Reinhardt, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, my pleasure.
One of the things that I'm interested to learn as I was reading your biography is that, in fact, you were born in Joliet and grew up in Illinois.
Yes, I was born in Joliet and raised in a little town about 4 miles away from there called New Lenox.
So we don't have a whole lot of mountains here in this part of the United States. How is it that you became a climber?
Long story, but in short, I think basically it was the interest in exploring different places around the world, and mountains tended to hold some of the things that most interested me at the time, including some tribes that I began to look for when I went to the Himalayas.
So this, what your interest in anthropology, archaeology came first?
It was a mixture. I think at the same time I started climbing at the University of Arizona, for example, I was also beginning in anthropology and archaeology, and realized that the two could combine. In other words, mountain climbing could be like a tool. You don't have to climb mountains necessarily if you're trying to reach other tribes or little-known tribes, but you might find those skills rather useful if you're trying to, say, get over into different isolated valleys.
Yeah. I guess, and it's my understanding, too, that particularly when you started out doing your work, the there weren't all that many people doing high-altitude archaeology. And I guess for the obvious reason that not only do you have to have the expertise to do the archaeology, but you also have to have the skill and the experience to do the climbing and to work at those altitudes. One of the mountains that you were where you made this find was 20,000 feet, and that's... It's not easy to even just to function at 20,000 feet.
Well, that's right. And to tell you the truth, there still aren't very many of us. In fact, there are two that do it more or less full time. One of them is a young lady in Argentina who's been climbed, I think, more than 100 peaks in about 5 or 6 years. It's quite an extraordinary lady. But yes, it's difficult because you do need to have this combination of obviously training in archaeology and also mountaineering. So it's kind of like a subfield of archaeology.
Mm-hmm. This, let's talk a little bit about this particular mountain that where you found the Ice Maiden. This is in Peru, in an area kind of along the coast, along the Pacific coast, where there are a chain of these mountains. Was there some reason that the particular mountain, Ampato, was the one that you first decided to explore?
Actually, ironically, it was one of the last that I did explore. The reason for that was it's 20,700 feet and it's permanently snow-capped. And I had climbed most of the other peaks in the region in years before, in the 80s in particular. And I never climbed it because the Incas normally wouldn't go up a mountain that's permanently snow-covered. They would make the offerings from a more distant spot. And the reason I climbed this particular one was to take photos of its neighbor, which was in eruption.
And these are all of these things volcanoes, or were once volcanoes?
Most of them. The ones we're talking about in southern Peru are almost all volcanoes, but there are other peaks. For example, Aconcagua in southern in Argentina is actually not a volcano.
Hmm. So it was you're going up this particular mountain that was, in a sense, a kind of a surveying, just to look around. But it was known that there had been there had been burials by Inca on high mountaintops surrounding this particular one in this area.
Yeah, exactly. What had happened is we'd done some expeditions there. I have worked with Peruvian archaeologists before, particularly in the 80s and into 91. And we had already found a human sacrifice, albeit it wasn't well preserved. That's why it didn't get the attention. On a peak at about 18,500 feet, not that far from Ambato, this peak where we found the Ice Maiden. So we had been doing this. We had an actual series of expeditions that took place over time. But in the case of Ambato, it was purely by chance. I was just really trying to get some photos.
Mm-hmm. And just the story, as you tell in the book, it apparently, and this was connected with the fact that that an adjacent peak there had been an eruption, that as a result the snow on Ambato had melted, and that had exposed this burial site that otherwise you would never have found. Maybe nobody ever would have found it.
Well, that's right. And the peak had been climbed before. It didn't have that many ascents. It's fairly isolated and relatively difficult, but. The main concern that I had was with that kind of deep snow, there was no way, even if the Incas had built something, there was no way that we could see it. And no climber had ever seen it without snow. So it made it pretty much a loss. My climbing partner, Miguel Zarate, was very interested in getting to the summit, but frankly, it's one of the few peaks I climbed where I wasn't really that interested in reaching it, at least until we got higher up and started to see traces of the Incas.
Yeah. I guess it should not come as a surprise that for so many people around the world that mountains are sacred places. High places are sacred places, and maybe that comes with thinking that the gods are up in the sky somewhere, and that the closer you can get, the closer you are to where the gods are. And as far as the Inca were concerned, that there was no difference there. It was just like a lot of other places. Though in their case, that apparently not only did the Inca think that the gods were up there, but that they had a way of thinking of the mountains themselves as gods.
Yeah, there's some controversy about just the degree to which they personalized them, but basically they could see the mountains taking many forms. So we shouldn't just think of them. They just saw, say, the mountain as a god itself. The mountain was inhabited by a deity, and this deity could take different forms, even that of a mountain climber, in theory. So people would see them in their dreams. They'd see them sometimes when they were wandering through the mountains, or the mountains could take the form of, say, condors overflying and observing sort of their terrain that they dominated below. And you mentioned about the mountains being sacred around the world. That's certainly true in the traditional religions. And even to a large degree, to major religions such as Buddhism today, Buddhism and Hinduism. One of the research projects I began to get involved in, ironically after I first went to the Andes, not before, was the study of the importance of sacred mountains in Hinduism and Buddhism. But I found a very practical reason to why the people were worshiping them, and that's that they felt they controlled water, weather, and through that, the fertility of the crops and livestock. So they were extremely important economically and still are in many regions today.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Jan Reinhard. He's a high-altitude archaeologist. He's also an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. And he's written about some of his work and some of the things that he has found in a book that was published a little bit earlier this summer. The book is titled The Ice Maiden, and it's published by National Geographic Books. And if you're interested in archaeology, maybe you'd like to see some of the photographs of some of the things that he's found and read about his experiences, go out to the bookstore and look for the book. And, of course, questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As have some other people, various places around the world, the Inca practiced human sacrifice, although perhaps not with the great enthusiasm that some others, like the Aztec, did. They certainly did. What was for them? What was the function of the human sacrifice? Why were they doing it?
At a couple, I think, at a state level, in other words, the level of the Inca emperor, these were done in extremely important cases. For example, the coronation of a new emperor or the death of an emperor and so on, these kinds of really critical situations in the polity of the nation. For the communities that are further distant from around the center of the Inca Empire in Cusco in Peru, we found that basically they seem to have more of orientation towards the mountains themselves as being important places that were controlling, for example, like I mentioned, weather. In this case, if a severe drought or severe rain, as far as that goes, was destroying the crops, they would think that this had some causative part on the part of the mountains. In other words, they would want to worship the mountains and give them offerings so that they would make things better.
Mm-hmm. And that was the idea that the mummies that you'd found, and they are they're the bodies of children, sometimes boys, sometimes girls. They were indeed offered as offerings to the gods, and that the idea was, I guess, that they would go and they would be in some sort of form, would be with the gods. And so not only was it an offering, I guess, as I understand it, the idea was that they also would be a kind of intermediary between the people, between their people and the gods.
Yeah, in essence, they became deified because we know from the historical documents that the people in the surrounding region would continue to worship the children, who then became like quasi-deities or adults in their minds. They were ambassadors into the realm of the gods, and they themselves, because they had directly living with the deities, they could help influence the deities to, for example, help with the fertility of crops or whatever. And so it was extremely important. I think the key thing here is that from the Inca's perspective, it was an honor. We know of some cases where parents even offered their children. And the idea was they weren't being sacrificed and then just, you know, it's like some food offering of some sort. Rather, they were entering into another realm, and they were going to live forever. And they were going to live, in fact, a lot better than the average person would, who would die and then kind of just disappear eventually. So these children, and they were children because they were pure, and they therefore could be more acceptable to the deities. These children then were constantly communicated with. They didn't die in the sense that we know that some of them even spoke through shamans, even generations after they had died. And so that in the people's minds, they were still living there in the mountains.
When people hear mummy, I'm sure that what they think of is Egypt and the mummies that have been found that came from ancient Egypt. And these things were deliberately mummified. There was a process that was gone through. The internal organs were removed. The bodies were treated with certain things so that they wouldn't deteriorate. And so, as I say, when people hear mummy, they think mummy. What we're talking about here, though, are bodies that were, were naturally mummified. They weren't treated in any way. It was the conditions under which they were, in the place they were put, that resulted in them being as remarkably preserved as they are. What is it about the place that these bodies were placed that made them last and maintain such a really remarkable condition over, in the case of the Ice Maiden, for example, she's 500 years old.
Right. Well, for starters, of course, it's plenty cold up there. The Incas also buried them, and this is a little unusual. The Incas normally didn't bury bodies. They'd put them in their overhangs and in these sort of funerary towers and so on in different parts of the empire. In the case of the children, they actually buried them, so that also helped. You get a kind of a combination of things where you have the just the physical terrain. In other words, they were buried and kept in this way, somewhat desiccated and so on. And then cold to boot. And, of course, at those altitudes, you don't get the kind of flesh-eating bacteria that you would get at lower altitudes that brings about decomposition. So what you end up with are, in some cases, actually we found better preserved mummies on 22,000 feet in Argentina. And they are as if somebody just died a few days ago. The DNA is perfect, like living humans, and the brains are completely intact, not shrunken, and so on and so forth. So the kind of work that can be done and the knowledge we can gain from them is like that you can gain from a living human, which is really never-ending, which is one reason that they're so valuable.
Yeah, it's interesting that some years ago I talked with the author of a book that was about some kind of similar mummies, although they were a lot older, that were found in Central Asia, and that the same thing sort of applied when you looked at the photographs of the people. They were amazingly well-preserved, and these people were thousands of years old, and what was really striking about them was that all the textiles that were with them, their clothing, looked virtually brand new.
Right. That's an incredible area. Of course, it's because it's so dry there. And I should add that, however, it's difficult to imagine, but on the summits, there actually can be unfreezing. And that means that some of the bodies that we have found have, in fact, decomposed. You'll get the, over a 500-year time span, you'll get periods in which it's been fairly dry. And that means that snow would have melted and penetrated into the ground and so on. So just being high in and of itself isn't a guarantee that they're going to be frozen or found that way.
Yeah. Let's talk with a caller, and this person is in a nearby community, Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. I would like to ask you guest a bit of a question that has puzzled me. If you look here in the Western Hemisphere, many of the indigenous people, when you get south of Rio Grande, have done some amazing things. You know the Aztecs and Mayans and the Incas and Toltecs, and you just go on and on all the way down to the Nuncas, the carvings onto the ground and stuff. But yet, if that didn't go into northern portions of our continent, is there any reason why there was that segregation?
That's an interesting point, because actually the latest studies have been made have found incredibly complex cultures in the woodlands, in other words, in the sort of central east of the United States.
Yes, in the southeastern United States, but they don't seem to have the buildings and the edifices and the huge monuments they do, except for maybe Cahokia.
But, right, exactly.
Yeah, but that's a little bit different yet. I mean, they just piled up dirt, which in itself was an accomplishment.
Oh, it was an accomplishment.
But when you're talking about hauling rocks to the top of a mountain, that's another thing.
Well, I'll certainly give you that. And I think it's one of the most incredible accomplishments that's really comparable to the construction of the pyramids. People kind of roll their eyes when they say that, but we have to imagine the Inca Empire was less than 100 years in the time period that they were in, the region of the Andes where they built most of these sites, and we're talking of over 100 of them, over 17,000 feet. This was a time span of about 50 years, so it was quite phenomenal. People had not even reached these altitudes, let alone built sites in them, until the 1850s. That's 400 years later. So the Incas were the first true, I think, mountaineers, and they actually did a little technical climbing, couple of spots. So it's quite an accomplishment. Is to get back to the question about why they weren't in the north. Unfortunately, I'm an Inca person. I don't have the answers to just what was the process of going on in North America, but my impression is that there was a considerable amount of movement throughout the region through the years, and therefore maybe there was simply a nomadic lifestyle that didn't lend itself to construction of major buildings.
I see. It seems, though, if you go along the western United States, it's very similar in some aspects to the Andes along the Chilean and Peruvian and Ecuadorian coast. Not quite as tall, but still very similar in a lot of nature, a lot of ways. It's just strange that they wouldn't flourish as well in either place.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's a question that I'm unqualified to answer.
It's probably lost in time.
Well, that's one thing. I suspect that with time, the archaeologists are going to come up with a explanation as to what was going on. Usually there's some kind of factors that kind of come together, things like maybe the particular problems in economics and so on in the regions that didn't lend themselves well to exploitation and concentrations of groups and population increase. I don't know, but anyway, you're right. That's something to certainly research and try and find out more about.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Well, let me introduce again our guest for this hour of the show, Johan Reinhardt. He's a high-altitude archaeologist. He's also an explorer-in-residence at the National Geographic Society. Since 1980, he's conducted anthropological field research in Peru, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, and Ecuador. And back in 1995, he made this discovery that we're talking about here this morning of an Inca girl that was offered as a sacrifice. Found her body on the top of Peru's Mount Amparo. That was a discovery that was chosen by Time magazine as one of the world's 10 most important scientific discoveries of that year, and got a lot of coverage in the popular press and also in the National Geographic. He's lived also for more than 10 years in the Himalaya and did anthropological research in Nepal, Tibet, Bhutan, and India. And if you would like to read about the Ice Maiden, you can look at the book that he's authored. It came out a little earlier this summer, and that's the title, The Ice Maiden. It's published by National Geographic Books. Questions are welcome on this show, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, back at near the beginning of the half hour, we're talking about the fact that you had climbed Ampato not with any particular thing in mind other than to climb and also to take some pictures of a neighboring peak that was where there was a volcano that was erupting at the time, and that conditions had been such that the snow had melted and this burial site had been uncovered, and in fact that the Ice Maiden had been up at a higher level and had fallen down. And I think as you tell the story, you saw something. You weren't really quite sure what it was, and you went over to investigate, check it out.
Yeah, that's right. We actually, when we first saw it, our first instinct was to think that it was, in fact, a mummy bundle. Mm. But it seemed so unlikely to see one laying out on the surface that our next thought was that maybe it was a climber's backpack or perhaps even a climber. We knew this because we'd reached the summit and seen that this man-made platform had existed there. The snow had been cleared away, and part of this platform was still there, but the majority of it had fallen down about 200 feet through the right into the center of the crater, and we couldn't actually see where it would reach. So I threw a couple of stones down these different gullies that led down, and because we couldn't climb straight down, we didn't have a rope, but we had to go around into the crater, and I wrapped them up in yellow plastic, and we eventually found one of the stones, and near it was the mummy bundle.
Mm-hmm. So when you opened, can you describe what the experience was like when you opened this up and suddenly found yourself looking in the face of this now long 500-year long dead girl?
Well, that's the that was the surprising thing, because we didn't open her up. What had actually happened is we could just see a bundle, but it was attached to like a pedestal of ice that had melted from around it. And I asked my climbing companion to lift it up off the ice, and when he did, it kind of revolved in his arms a bit as he tried to get a better hold on the bundle, and all of a sudden we were staring into the face of this Inca child, and that was an unforgettable moment. The thing is in the fall, the cloth had been ripped off that had been covering her face, and of course we had no way of knowing that, so that was when the shock hit.
This, I'm sure that in dealing with human remains like this, it is unlike dealing with any other artifact. One of the things that's striking is that someone named her, gave her a name, Juanita. So you can't get around the fact that that whatever this is now, this was once a human being. How does that affect the way that you deal with what you find, and how is that different knowing that this was a person?
Yeah, nothing can come close to the looking into the face of a dead person who's obviously been, in this case, fairly well preserved, because it does take on an individuality of its own. One of the problems that we've had actually in the laboratory is that people begin to literally view it as their child. It becomes a sense of transference takes place. This was an individual, and you're constantly finding out more about the individual. You end up finding out, we know in some cases, the meals that they've had or the kind of change in diet they had a year before they died. And we can see the changes that take place in isotopes and so on. So they have a personal story, which makes them even more more human, I guess, to our comprehension. And it's quite a sense of a relationship takes place, which is not unlike that of that with a friend.
Yeah. When you found her, she was frozen.
Oh yeah. And unfortunately, with the Ice Maiden, because the face had been exposed, it was fairly desiccated. It was the rest of the body that was extremely well preserved. For example, in the case of the three mummies we found at 22,000 feet, their bodies are, except for one which was hit by lightning in the burial, are incredibly well preserved, and the faces included. So it's quite a bit different. I want to stress that for us, it's a combination. On the one hand, we're scientists, and we're very interested in learning more about the cultures of these people. And these mummies are time capsules. On the other hand, we strongly believe that there should be no intrusive measures taken with them. They should be treated like, say, a living patient in a hospital would be. If you're taking needle biopsies, you would do the same thing with a living person to try and find out something about them, or DNA samples and so on. That's on the one hand, and we want to make sure that they're well conserved. That's the key thing, because obviously, if they're not conserved, then there's no more information. And on the one hand, and on the other hand, you're not doing them or any relatives of theirs who might exist any favors. So the idea is to try and keep them conserved in a respectful way. In which the integrity of the not only the body but also all of the items that were found with the mummies are kept intact.
One of the stories that I came across, now this is several years old, but did deal in fact with the fact that because the bodies were so well preserved, you could extract DNA, and then what you could do is you could actually go out and see if there were any living relatives of these people. Were you able to find anyone who could trace their lineage to any of these people that you found?
One of them is right near here in Washington, D.C. It turns out there's a community from Kabanakonde, a village at the foot of Ampapata, and we've taken 19 samples from 19 people. And to compare with the Ice Maiden's DNA, there was no comparison, but by incredible coincidence, there was with the, also called the Ice Maiden, one of the older children that we found at 22,000 feet in 1999 in Argentina. There was only one base pair difference out of 1,123 that they examined in the DNA, mitochondrial DNA, between her and a living person who originated from this little village at the foot of Ampapu and who currently lives in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the challenges we know that that anthropologists and archaeologists have dealt with in recent years is having to, and appropriately so, having to respect the wishes of living communities of indigenous people who are concerned about what happens to their artifacts and the remains of their ancestors that may be discovered in archaeological work or may have been dug up sometime in the past and may be in some museum somewhere. And there has been a lot of controversy and discussion, I'm sure, within the anthropology community about what to do about that. Here, I would think that that might even be a little bit more difficult here in this particular case, where you can actually have people that that could trace their lineage in a almost direct sort of way, or at least would could say that they had a much more direct, where the relationship between the find and living people is much closer and much more direct.
Absolutely, and of course there have been some of those issues that have been raised. My position is very clear. If there are communities that consider these sites sacred and do not want them touched and can protect them, then under no circumstances would I want to be involved in anything to do with them. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, these high mountains can be ascended from many sides and are ascended from many sides, and there's been extensive looting going on, not just on the mountains, much more extensive even in the lowlands. Hundreds of thousands of tombs have been looted. And there have been, in 1995 when we went to Ampato, the reason I went was to begin again with this project that we had left lie dormant since 1991, because I heard that looters had used dynamite and blown up a body on the summit of a peak right outside of Arequipa, the city that we were in southern Peru. And I thought, well, you know, it's a race against time. These are going to be looted and destroyed forever. And that's an incredible loss, both to the indigenous peoples and, of course, to humanity in general, in the sense of giving us a chance to understand more about our past and, in their case, their past. So if there could be any kind of protection of these sites, then that would be wonderful. You get to another issue. Actually, once indigenous peoples understand that we really are conserving, protecting, and keeping the information together, publishing, making it available, and so on and so forth, and trying to help the communities in many cases, we haven't had any particular problems. There is a difference, though, in display, and that's particularly the case in the United States, the display of a dead body. I personally have no feelings one way or the other than that I think that the display can only be done if you have the same conservation of the mummies as you would if they were not on display. But display is a cultural issue, display of the dead, in the sense that in the Andes, virtually every museum down there has mummies on display, including there was one on display in the high school in the village at the foot of Ampato. So they view that not as a lack of respect, but as a showing of respect, obviously, if it's not done in a carnival atmosphere. In the United States, you have a whole different issue, because you had Native American graves being dug up, and some of them fairly recent, you know, and bones being taken to museums and so on, put on display in carnival shows, and there were living descendants of these people, and still are, and they quite rightly are upset at that.
Where are they now? Where is the Ice Maiden now, and the other people that you found?
Yeah, the Ice Maiden is on display in a museum in Arequipa. It's a city of a million people in southern Peru. It has quite elaborate systems of alarms and protective things, and 24-hour guards, and so on and so forth, and obviously monitoring of the temperature and relative humidity and things like that. There's another museum that was just opened, which has the mummies in Argentina, in Salta, in another wonderful colonial city in northwest Argentina. And the mummies are not on display there yet. They have been very cautious about getting any kind of units that would display mummies without having them meet these very exacting specifications, quite expensive. They've just begun work on making one of these units. I personally, like I said, I found that I would have preferred personally they not be on display, just because it's easier to control the conditions, I think, generally speaking. On the other hand, it is amazing the amount of good that it brings to the indigenous people and to the communities in general. For example, the Iceman, who was found in the Alps, this Neolithic man whose body's on display in northern Italy. The educational value has been phenomenal, and that's also the case with these mummies in Peru and in Argentina. Children, school children, getting involved, they're like magnets. Mummies are like magnets. Mummies and dinosaurs, they're the two things that really attract the attention of people. And when you attract a child to something like that, you can then deal with things like DNA, like geography, history, geology, race. You can talk about how there really is, you know, in our DNA, not major distinctions between the races, and so on and so forth. You can deal with many issues basing that on something that captures the child's or the people's imagination. Mummies cut across cultural lines. I mean, this was front page news in India and China, and they cut across age lines and status lines, everything. The President of the United States, Bill Clinton, was extremely interested in the Ice Maiden. So it reaches lots of people, and it affects their lives in ways that I never anticipated.
Let's talk with someone else, someone on cell phone near Bloomington, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. Fascinating show. And I was just interested, not to get too cryptic about this whole thing, but the tech, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. The technique as to the sacrifice of the mummy or the child at that time, were you able to tell what technique was used, and was the same technique used all the time, and would that have led to any sort of decay of the body? In other words, if it was some sort of a knife wound or something, would that have had some sort of a deleterious effect upon the body? Or if it was a poison maybe that they had to drink, would that be more conducive to the body lasting as long as it did? And I'm on the cell, so I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call.
Yes. It was fascinating because until we started finding these mummies intact on mountain summits, and not just were the mummies intact, but also the artifacts that are buried with them, we really weren't able to compare or understand what the Spanish chroniclers, the earliest writers, because the Incas didn't have writing. So the earliest writing begins after the Spanish conquest of 1532. And we're getting documents that talk about the Incas telling them what happened at these ceremonies. But we didn't have the evidence to kind of compare it to, and a lot of people thought that these were just the Spanish trying to badmouth the Incas or so on. And what we are able to do is, of course, find these intact and see the different things that were buried with them and the techniques that were used to kill the children in some cases. We know from the historical documents that they said that they were sometimes buried alive, they were sometimes smothered, they were sometimes hit by blows to the head, sometimes strangled. These were the main techniques that were used. Stabbing, we actually only recently found one case where that appears to have occurred. And generally, it seems to have been a blow to the head. And I can say, you know, all of these sound awful and are awful if you're trying to live through it, but of course, we have to think in terms of what they were thinking at that time and their concepts. For example, a blow to the head, I've heard that that's awful. I've been knocked cold myself a half dozen times, and you don't know you've been hit until you wake up. I mean, it's one of those things where there's no good way to die, but there's certainly some ways which are a little bit easier to take than others. I think when we talk also about the smothering, we found that that probably were stupefied. We know that from the historical text. We don't know that so much from the evidence thus far we see in the burials. In other words, for one thing, physically, you get at those altitudes. These children have never been up at any altitude like that before. Let me tell you, I've been climbing mountains for most of my life, and you still are plenty tired at 20-some thousand feet, no matter how many times you do it. And for a child like that, must have been already close to dying up there when they reach those altitudes. And so we also have been told that they would sometimes give them this maize beer to drink to grant, and so on, so that they would be sleeping. In essence, they would die asleep.
What other sorts of things have you been able to learn by being able to do a scientific analysis of the bodies that you found?
Well, for example, one of the interesting studies was done on the hair. You can tell from the hair, the isotopes that are in there, the kinds of foods that were being eaten. So we know that for a couple of years, for example, there was a rather steady diet, and then about a year before the sacrifice, we know that the diet started to change. That kind of goes in accord with the historical documents, that these children were sent to the center of the Inca Empire and honored and received special foods, because the food begins to be meat and maize, which were more high-status items than potatoes that were the common food. So you see this change taking place, and also we find from the hair that, at least in some cases of the children, five or six cases thus far, these were children who were chewing coca. Also unusual to find that in children. And that coca chewing was associated more with adult status, but also with ritual context. And so we can find out those kinds of things. We can, and we haven't done it yet, because the quantities are still fairly large that are needed. But once the techniques are a little bit more finalized, we'll be able to take blood and find out the different kinds of diseases that they had because of the antibodies that occur in the blood, infectious diseases. Yeah. So there's a number of different kinds of things you can find out about the individual. Obviously, looking at the stereolithographic CAT scans, you can determine that they had problems of other kinds of problems that might appear, broken bones or other kinds of diseases that might have left traces.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Johan Reinhard. He is a high-altitude archaeologist. He's explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. And if you'd like to read about some of his experiences, you can look at the book, The Ice Maiden. It's subtitled Inca Mummies, Mountain Gods, and Sacred Sites in the Andes. It's published by National Geographic Books. He's done quite a lot of anthropological field research in Peru, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina, and Ecuador. He's also lived in the Himalaya and done work in Nepal, Tibet, Bhutan, and India. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the sorts of problems in the sense that you write about is with this particular discovery is the fact that you, as we have explained, you'd gone up basically just to do some surveying, to look around, to take some pictures, and when you found the Ice Maiden, you had not had authorization. You didn't have a permit to take anything from the site, and your feeling was when you found her that and the things that you found that you felt you couldn't just leave them there because there would be a fair chance that someone would come along and take them or destroy them. So you said, well, for purposes of trying to preserve this material, you need to take it back. But then you also knew that when you got back, no doubt you were going to have to deal with the authorities or somebody who was going to say, look. Yeah, your motivation might have been fine, but we didn't give you permission to do this.
Yes, that's certainly, and that's what happened. I when I gave the press conference, spoke at the press conference, I made the point, and fortunately, the vast majority of the public agreed with it, and that's that the job of the archaeologist is to preserve, not to leave them to be destroyed. And I was less concerned about climbers or looters coming across the mummy. I mean, they're fairly difficult to locate, than I was with the climate. The mummy was laying out. We didn't know how long the mummy had been laying out. It clearly had not been out there that long, because just a year and a half, or 3 years before, there had been a climber up there, and the summit was still completely snow-covered. In fact, it was 30 feet, the summit ridge was 30 feet wide. When we went up there, it was 3 feet wide. So a large section of the summit ridge had collapsed fairly recently and exposed these items. The feathers on the statues, beautifully preserved, could not have been in the sun very long because they were still fresh, and they were like new. And obviously, if you leave them exposed to the sun, it's a lot of people don't understand that it can actually be extremely hot at high altitudes, and that's because you have this reflection off the snow, and the sun is very intense up there, and so leaving the items out. On the other hand, it was impossible to bury them. It was rock hard. I mean, it was a mixture of ice and rock, gravel, and there was we didn't have the ability to bury the items. And then there was the problem of, you know, when would we ever get back? You never know. You never know about permits and so on and so forth. I thought the only real option was to try and get them down. Now, the question was, would we? The mummy weighed over 100 pounds, so and we had been climbing for days, so and not eating very well. So that was the main challenge, and get them back before, in the case of the mummy, before the mummy would start to melt. And not the mummy, but the ice. In any event, it was a race against time. All of these different, there was a lot of factors that had to be taken into consideration. You couldn't get a helicopter up there. You couldn't drive near the mountain. So even if we came back with an expedition, we'd kind of be in the same situation of being in a rush to get the things back to a freezer. So made the decision to try and get the mummy off. Unfortunately, we did, and there was absolutely no loss. There was still ice on the mummy when we got into the city.
Yeah, the book has some photographs, and they're really stunning of what it's like on the top of these mountains. There's one picture here of some of the members on this mountain in Argentina, and I have no idea. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name.
Yeah, it's a tough one.
It must just be the most stunning kind of experience. I know physically very challenging, but to stand in a place like that and just look around, it must just be physically your breathing is going to be difficult anyway. I was going to say it would take your breath away.
Yeah, good point. Well, it takes your breath away is when you try to do any work. that's when you really lose it quickly. I have to give credit to the team. Obviously, I couldn't have done any of this without a great team of people who, and this was a group that came together over the course of years, primarily Peruvians that I've been working with. And without them, I mean, my goodness, we were 2 weeks at living at 22,000 feet, and we'd been 10 days at 20,000 feet just a short time before that, not to mention other, you know, ferrying loads up to the summit and so on and so forth. So these, and then carrying out an excavation over a two-week period. So these people deserve incredible credit and the thanks, I think, of all of us. On the other hand, it's kind of ironic. It's more a mental challenge than a physical one in many ways, because it's amazing how quickly discouraged and just completely worn out, maybe depressed is even the right word, when you're working up there and nothing seems to be happening for hours, or in some cases days, in some cases weeks. And it's extremely difficult to keep a group of people motivated and working in those kinds of conditions. So it's a combination. It's not just physical. It's also mental.
Yeah. Let's talk. We'll try to quickly get another caller in here before we find ourselves out of time. Someone in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I have two questions. The first is that you said they didn't have a written language, the Incas, but I thought they had a really efficient communication system based on runners. So was that all oral communication?
Yeah, that's your first question. Yes, they had an incredible system of runners, the Chaskis. And the Chaskis did two things. They could pass it on orally, but they also passed on quipus, these knotted strings, which were phenomenal devices. They're just really beginning to understand them now, and it's very difficult because of all the years that have passed. But there's been this recent work that's helping to decode them. But these were devices for recording. So you could do, for example, recording the sacred places or the items that were offered at sacred places, the numbers of people, the numbers of objects being kept in supply houses, and so on and so forth. And they were not writing per se. In other words, writing, replicating language. So they did lack that.
Okay, and then my second question is a little sort of professional ethics. I know Deschardins, who was a paleontologist who worked in China, when you read some of his writings, you're almost not unaware of the fact that there was a revolution going on or what was happening in the lives of the people that he obviously had working with them, helping him. And I noticed Mr. Inge gave the list of the places that you've been to, you've been into some places where there's lots of revolutionary turmoil going on, and I guess my question is, what's your responsibilities, or how do you feel about the work that you do when you're working in the past, but there's present issues? How does it affect your work?
Yeah, well, I must say, most of the time, for example, Shining Path was quite active in the 80s, early 90s, when I was working in Peru and made for some scary situations. I believe that you need to work with the local people on two different ways. One is the local archaeologist, and that's why I almost never have Americans with me, for example. In other words, you have to leave something for the future, and these people continue to work and hopefully get jobs and so on, and that's one of the things I've strived to do. The other is the communities themselves, that they are able to benefit in some way. Sometimes it's not direct. There might not be a lot of money around or something, but at least with pride in their culture, knowing that efforts have been made to keep the things kept for them, for future generations and so on, and also involving them as far as possible. Most of them can't, although we did have a mayor and a judge on top of us, with us, still on a website, a NOVA website, Expedition to Sarasara. Whenever we can, we try to get them involved as much as possible. In the midst of all this, I'm obviously not a military person or somebody to be involved in politics. I'm mainly concerned with trying to help the communities, and also, as my profession is, to help save and understand the past. Those are the principal goals: conservation, preservation, and to what degree possible, assisting communities. For example, I have now museums that only have items found from our expeditions in three countries. One of them is a site museum in a community out in Island of the Sun in Lake Titicaca, and the other two I mentioned previously in Salta and Arequipa and the major cities. And we've also established, however, site museums in other villages as well. These are sources of income for the people, and also help them have pride in their own past, because they've been looked down upon. One of the reasons there are these revolutions like the Shining Path is the fact that people have been oppressed for so long and looked down upon. And so one of the ways I try to help is through helping with their preserving their past and a pride in their past and in their own present culture.
I must jump in here because we're at the end of the time and we're going to have to stop. Our guest, John Reinhardt, is explorer in residence of the National Geographic Society. He's written many books and articles. If you would like to read this story that we have talked about, look for his book, The Ice Maiden. It's published by National Geographic Books. And Dr. Reinhardt, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on your program, Dave.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus 580 will continue, so please stay tuned.
Programs on AM 580 are made possible in part with a grant from the Carl Cancer Center, creating positive outcomes with expertise, innovation, and inspiration. Patient stories at carlcancerfighters.com. Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at agrigold.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at midday. Prices have been fairly volatile in the wheat pits, both in Kansas City and at the Chicago Board of Trade. Let's go ahead and get you caught up on the particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat now trading at 9.73, down 6. July, 8.39, down 15 and 3 quarters. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 914 and a half, down 19 and a half. March, 930.